The Natural Nurse with Ellen Kamai and Dr. Z, Mondays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Thank you so much for joining us right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z comes to you each week, 1 to 2 p.m. on Monday, right after Gary Nell, right here on Progressive Radio Network, Gary Nell's network. And you can always listen anytime online at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com by just going to the archives, The Natural Nurse. So we're so happy to be bringing you cutting-edge information from topics in natural medicine every week. Dr. Zamprone and myself, we are co-hosts here at The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Dr. Zamprone is Dr. Z. And we have been bringing you information about natural medicine since 1980. So that's been a long time, and we've been with Progressive Radio Network since its inception. Today, we are very happy to have as our guest Dr. Andrew Campbell. Dr. Campbell was educated in Switzerland and is a multinational kind of person, receiving a medical degree and also completing his residency at the Medical College of Georgia. And he is fluent in six languages. He has served as a consultant to the National Institute of Health, National Institute of Dental Research, and the CDC. In addition, Dr. Campbell has been featured on many media events, including 2020, the Montel Williams Show, 24-hour investigative news, and local channels throughout the United States, Canada, and Mexico. And he has lectured throughout the world on the effect of mold, silicon, and other toxins. In addition, Dr. Campbell is the editor-in-chief of Alternative Therapies in Health and Medicine, and is on the editorial board of many other medical journals. So we want to welcome Dr. Andrew Campbell to our show today, right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. How are you doing today, Dr. Campbell?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
So right after we spoke off air just a little while ago, I did just Google your name on and put in Dr. Andrew Campbell, Andrew W. Campbell, mold, and immediately got a lot of published research. And I'm looking at one called Mold and Mycotoxins, Effects on the Neurological and Immune System in Humans. So this is something you certainly have been investigating for quite a while.
Yes, for a number of years I've been looking at the effects of mold ever since we discovered that medicine in general discovered that there's more to it than just allergies.
That's so true. Now, one of the things that I have seen in my research, both as a dark field microscope investigator, which I have been since 1976, as well as dealing with so many patients, is that there seems to be an underestimation, particularly in mainstream allopathic medicine, on how much mold and fungi can have to do with people's feeling well or not.
Yes, and I think, especially in this country, if it's not FDA approved and whatnot, it's not looked at, not taught. However, even infectious disease specialists don't know that much about mold, but there are, in my library alone, I have over 1,000 articles from all over the world, but I'd say 50% are from the United States, discussing the effects of molds on humans.
Yeah,
and it's been known for a very long time.
It has so much. And what I often feel is the case is when there's not necessarily one drug therapy that can take care of a particular issue, then it's not discussed.
Well, interestingly enough, Pfizer and Merck in the last 2-3 years, 4 years, have come out with a whole new class of medications that treat molds. It kills molds. It's like an antibiotic, but it's called an antifungal. And I think what they've looked at is they've looked at the future and know that they're going to recoup their costs in developing these new drugs. So I'm hoping that medicine will pick up on this, because so many people go to doctor to doctor to doctor to doctor without ever getting an accurate diagnosis, using a lot of different drugs, and then they give up on drugs and start using nutritional supplements, but often without the help of someone like you who could really guide them and in taking the right combination.
So it's something that often remains a mystery. And what originally got you interested in this specialty in medicine? You obviously have a vast amount of training in conventional medicine, and yet your eyes remained open to this causative factor of illness.
Correct. I published some articles back in the early 90s on the effects of silicone in women. And soon thereafter, Connie Chung came on national TV and told everybody that her implants were making her sick. So at that point, I started seeing women from just all over the world with problems due to silicone. Well, one of the problems is that plastic surgeons, when one would rupture, they'd remove both and put in a pair of new ones into the woman. They noticed that instead of kind of being a clear gel with a slightly hazy bluish tint, they were brown or they had black flecks inside, et cetera, et cetera. So they sent these off for analysis, and they found that these implants, many, if not most, had mold in them.
And interesting. So the person was actually developing mold in the implants.
Correct.
I've never heard of that. Very interesting.
Well, they actually was published by the plastic surgeons in some of their journals. And then soon thereafter, back in the 70s, and then soon thereafter on the package insert for breast implants, silicone breast implants, there was a part that said that there may be fungal contamination within the implant. But, of course, nobody read that part. So a lot of women felt sick from the implants, had them removed, and continued feeling sick. And that was due to the mold. So then I started treating them with antifungals back then and modified their diet, et cetera, and they got much better. And that's what started me on this process of finding out more about molds.
That's very interesting. So now what about the silicon itself? Does the silicon itself have some toxic components? Because I know that sometimes we hear about them leaking besides the mold issue.
Correct. If you took a silicone breast implant, the old kind, not the, there was this a period of years now that they had to redo the manufacturing and prove that they were safe, so they redid them. But back until the, I'd say the mid-90s, for a number of years, silicone breast implants, if you set it on a napkin and came back half an hour later, that napkin would have an oozy, oily spot on it. And so they ooze, they leak, and this causes a reaction with the immune system, and that causes what is known as the capsule, which is that very hard scar tissue around the implants, because the immune system, after trying to deal with this chemical oozing out into the body, tries to limit that by building scar tissue around it. And unfortunately, that scar tissue looks like Swiss cheese. It's full of holes, and so the silicone still got out, as did the molds. And, of course, they ruptured easily, although there were some women who had them in for 20 years and no rupture. There were some whose implants ruptured quite easily, or they had an accident or something, and they hit their chest and ruptured the implant, and then this stuff would get out throughout their body. And the women are who have that problem are quite ill, quite ill.
Well, in fact, it could be carcinogenic as well. And I have heard that even a high degree of invasion by mold and mold spores can initiate cancer and other more serious illnesses.
Correct. And I presented a paper at the National Institutes of Health in 1995 that showing that silicone is a potential carcinogen. Now, you throw that as a carcinogen in a woman, and then you have the mold as a potential carcinogen, actually the mycotoxin from the mold, and you have a very toxic situation of and affects women's health to a very, very large degree. And many of these ladies get very sick. They go from, again, doctor to doctor, trying to figure out what's wrong with them. Doctors do the traditional, I shouldn't say traditional, the conventional tests, and everything's normal. Your thyroid is normal. You don't have any problems with diabetes. Your kidneys are fine. Your liver's fine. It's all in your head. And so then they get very distraught because they feel terrible and no one can actually pinpoint what's wrong with them. And even if they do pinpoint what's wrong with them, most physicians don't know how to treat these issues. So they're kind of lost. Strangely enough, in other countries outside the United States, this is not as opaque as it is here. It's very much discussed. It's well known. People, the scientific and medical communities, discuss it, and so on. And it's open. There was a conference here in Dallas, the 26th annual international conference on man and his environment, and the whole 4-day conference was on molds. Many of the speakers were from other countries, including Europe and Mexico and Japan and England and so on and so forth. There were a number of doctors from the United States too, but there's very, very few and far between.
Well, what is making this become a more important and more prevalent problem at this point in history, or was it always an issue?
Well, in a sense, there were issues throughout history. Moses wrote about this, he said that if there's a growth on the wall, that the rabbi should come into that home and put a mark at that edge of that growth, and everybody should leave that home, and rabbi should come back a week later, and if his mark is covered with this growth, everything in the home and the home itself should be totally destroyed. So that was quite a while back. But during the Middle Ages, people were starving and they would eat moldy bread, and they developed what is known as St. Anthony's fire. And actually, that's a well-recognized neurological effect of the mold and mycotoxin in bread today. And in the 1930s, there was an epidemic in Russia of Stachybotrys mold. And 30% of the horses in Russia died from eating moldy hay. Now, we don't realize, but back in the 30s, especially in Russia, horses were what people used for transportation. It's like saying 30% of all trucks in the United States quit working. Well, that would be a huge effect on the economy. And these horses died. They didn't realize what it was until a very young commissar came by. His name was Khrushchev. Stalin sent him out there to figure out the problem, and he figured it out, and that's how he rose in the ranks of the Soviet Communist Party. But it killed a lot of horses. We've had a lot of outbreaks. In our country, we had a outbreak against chickens from killed poultry because they ate moldy corn back in the 1950s, and so they regulated it back then. it's not a new problem, but it's becoming more prevalent in humans because of the way we build things back then. And you can remember going to visit grandma's. Grandma didn't have air conditioning, didn't keep the windows shut, so all the windows were open, the fans were on, anything that flew in flew right back out.
Actually, you're so right, Dr. Campbell. Wow, I just had a flashback of visiting my grandmother. She lived in a walk-up in Brooklyn. And, boy, you know, people today think they cannot live without air conditioner. She just would have the fans on and the windows open all summer long, and she put her wash out the window. I remember that well. So we have to take a couple-minute break right here at Progressive Radio Network. Fascinating information, Dr. Campbell, and thank you so much. We are going to continue our discussion about molds and yeast and their link to illness, symptoms that might alert you to the fact that that is your health problem and what you can do about it. So we're going to be right back right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. So we're just going to continue our discussion. Sometimes we take a break at that point, and they introduce you to some of the other many wonderful shows that we have right here on Progressive Radio Network. And you have been describing to us an interesting story about the fact that the link between molds and disease actually is an ongoing condition that has affected humans and was recognized as far back as biblical times. I know you're putting together a website that will be up and running soon, and it's worth mentioning because our shows are archived here on Progressive Radio Network, and it will be called moldmedicine.com. But
it'll be mold-medicine.
Oh, I'm glad you told me that because I didn't write that down last time. Excellent. Mold-medicine.com. Now, you have not dropped the ball, however, on this very important causative agent in human suffering. So, like you said, there's different kinds of building technologies now. For instance, I know some people in Vermont, I visited their house last week. Instead of opening the windows, they actually have what's called an airtight home. And they have to rely on, as many office buildings do, internal circulatory systems that blow air around. And might not that be the perfect place for a mold to eventually actually grow and then be passed throughout the whole building?
Well, it puts those people at higher risk. And the reason is because anytime you close a building, things start growing and there's nothing that lets them out. As a matter of fact, one of the first Americans to ever write about this was Benjamin Franklin in Philadelphia. When he was living there, he closed every little crack, every little thing up in his room. And within a short time, he became quite ill and felt terrible, and he couldn't figure out. And then he, very intelligent man, realized what he had done and unplugged everything, and he started feeling better right away. So closing things up, and we have come to that due to the oil embargo that we suffered back in the early 1970s when OPEC cut off all the oil to the United States. And so the government said, okay, we're going to build energy-efficient buildings. These homes were built that way. Public buildings, office buildings were built that way. And what happens is the same air recirculates constantly so that that cold air in the summer and the warm air in the winter stays in, and it uses less energy to make colder air or warmer air. However, windows don't open. There's two sets of doors to get into buildings, et cetera, et cetera. And that causes some problems because of leaks that may occur. Anytime you have a leak, it has to be taken care of within 24 to 48 hours, because any longer than that, mold starts to grow. And when it grows very rapidly. If you clean it up and dry out the place before that, you're fine. But if not, mold's going to grow, it's going to sporulate, it's going to release mycotoxins, and you're going to become ill, and people won't know. And it's a very gradual thing. You start by first feeling tired and getting headaches and sinus problems, and then it just evolves, and then pretty soon you don't realize it, but every day you're not feeling well. and then you start going to the doctor, and these conventional doctors do what we talked about earlier. They run the usual gamut of tests, nothing shows up, and so they say it's in your head and send you to the psychiatrist, which is the wrong thing to do.
Well, usually first they'll give you antibiotics, which may in fact increase the growth of mold. And yes, then it's sort of a downward spiral, unfortunately.
It is. And the Mayo Clinic in 1999 published a very elegant study by Dr. Ponikow, who was their head of their ear, nose, and throat section. And this doctor decided that he was going to find out what is the most common cause of chronic sinusitis. You know, the chronic runny nose, the whatever you want to call it, that everybody suffers from. So he dug up in the sinuses and removed whatever he found and sent it to the lab. Did this on a little over 100 patients. I forgot exactly how many, but I think it was 110 or so. 96% what grew out was mold, not bacteria, not a virus. But you go today to your regular doctor and you said, I've got this runny nose, stuffy nose, chronic rhinosinusitis or chronic whatever, and they'll put you on an antibiotic. But that study by Dr. Ponikow started a series of studies showing that the most common element is mold, not bacteria, and people still get antibiotics to treat their colds.
That is,
and they shouldn't.
Of course, they're talking about the development of resistant strains due to the overuse of antibiotics. Now, I'm not sure that you have this information, Dr. Campbell, but was it the same mold growing out, or did they find different species?
They found several different species. I think Aspergillus, Penicillium, Cladosporium were the most common.
Well, I want to reintroduce you because since we didn't have our break, I did not have a chance to let our listeners know who we're talking to right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And I am sure you have never heard a show with more excellent information about this unbelievably common and ignored health problem, which is the health effects of mold and fungi, the real story. And we are listening today to our guest, Dr. Andrew Campbell, who is an MD, medical doctor, who has been educated actually around the world and is fluent in 6 languages. He is currently the editor-in-chief of Alternative Therapies in Health and Medicine. Many of you have heard us mention that journal before because it is a peer-reviewed journal that does publish excellent articles in natural medicine and natural therapies, and I'm on the editorial review board of that journal as well. And Dr. Campbell is on the editorial board of many medical journals. He continues to contribute to the advancement of medical science in the fields of immunology and toxicology, focusing on the toxicity of molds, silicon, and chemicals. He has 48 medical journal publications and chapters in medical books over the last 20 years. And Dr. Campbell has been recognized by Who's Who in the world and also in Who's Who in medicine and healthcare. And so we are very, very fortunate to have Dr. Campbell as our guest today. We have been talking about the long-term problem of fungi and molds as something that interferes with health and wellness, and the fact that, amazingly enough, it seems to be overlooked. And you just described to us, Dr. Campbell, the kinds of health issues, but they were a little vague, of course, and many people do start to have fatigue, and it can be due to many things. But it does seem that conventional medicine, if you don't have a blood reading that might be off, which of course this won't do necessarily. It won't make you anemic necessarily, and it won't make you have active white blood cells. So let me ask you that. Does that happen? Does the white blood cells not recognize mold the way it recognizes other invading organisms, so it wouldn't necessarily elevate the white blood cell count?
No, it doesn't really affect the white blood cell count. As a matter of fact, it depresses it because the substance that molds produce, these are mycotoxins, and one mold, one species of mold may produce a series of mycotoxins. And these suppress your immune system so that you get sicker quicker, you get sicker easier, you need longer time to get over things. And so patients with mold problems actually have a lower white blood cell count than a normal patient would.
So it's very hard to recognize through conventional blood work, then.
Very hard. I mean, again, unless you know what you're doing, doctors won't know. For instance, I'm not an obstetrician. So if you bring in a ultrasound machine, I'd know how to plug it in and probably turn it on, but I wouldn't know how to use it. In medicine, unless you read about molds, and there's textbooks, there's medical journal articles, there's all kinds of places where you can go, but if you don't take the time and effort to read these things, as a doctor, you're not going to know what to do or what tests to order or how to recognize it or how to treat it.
Well, let's talk about what tests can be done that actually might help a physician identify that mold is the causative agent in someone's illness.
The most direct tests and the simplest evidence of mold infestation is one is to do antibodies to mold via a test known as ELISA, ELISA, which is enzyme-linked immunoassay, but it's called ELISA for short. And the other one is you can do a urine test to detect mycotoxins. Both are available in this country. Both are used regularly by doctors who do recognize the issues of mold, although there's still very few and far between. And those are the two simplest tests. One a blood test and one a urine test. And all the doctor has to do is order it. And that's it. It's very simple. But unless, again, you take the time to read about it, doctors don't know. Once you get those results, you know what you're first of all, you know if mold is the issue or not. Second of all, you then have to treat the patient. The first rule in toxicology is get the patient out away from the toxin or the toxin away from the patient. So obviously you've got to help the patient figure out where this mold is. Is it in their home, in their workplace? Where are they getting affected?
How is that done? How do we recognize where it might be coming from?
Well, first you've got to have a suspicion. And most people are smart enough to try and figure out, I was worried about this or that or the other. And to those people who have no clue, you ask them questions. Have you had a leak in your home? No, I haven't.
Well, how many people have over the last month with all the earth changes and floods and hurricanes and earthquakes and things that we've had?
Of course. Think of Florida. Think of Katrina. Think of all of the flooding in the Midwest that's happened in these last several months. I mean, there's a lot of it. A lot of it. And again, people get sick and doctors don't recognize it, unfortunately. A few do, but most don't. I mean, even the Mayo Clinic publishes things and doctors don't read it. So, yes, unfortunately, there's a lot of it around, and you've got to figure out where did it come from, where am I being exposed. People don't look behind the washer and dryer. They don't look under the sink very much, things of that nature. But once you've established where it came from, that is a great help, because just by getting that out away from you and stopping that exposure you'll feel about 20% improvement. That's a general figure. Most people find that they're a little better, not much, but they're still better, and that's a positive. After that, you've got to start treating it. You've got to start treating these patients. And What is done is an antifungal is given. And secondly, you've got to change their nutrition. You've got to get them away from common sources of mold. For instance, peanuts. The government allows peanuts to contain a certain amount of aflatoxins. Although they're carcinogenic, there's still a very small amount that's in peanuts. Then there's cheeses that are made with moldy cheese. You've seen blue cheese and so on and so forth. Those are mold growing on the cheese.
Is that any less causative of illness than some of the other kinds?
In general, yes. But once you're sick from it, you want to help that patient by number one, educating them, and second of all, you don't want to potentially give them something that could be causing that kind of a problem for them. So you don't want to give them anything that may have a slightly more amount of mold in it than is common.
Even though it's a different species?
Correct.
Okay, so that's part of the treatment plan.
Yeah, and part of their treatment plan is you've got to help build up their immune system, too, because their immune system is affected. You've got to build that up, because what molds do and mycotoxins do is suppress the immune system. So they catch every bug that comes around and gets around them. So that's just, and I'm talking Reader's Digest version here, because obviously it's much more complex and much more, there's much more to it than just that.
Yes. Now, very often, mold, you can smell it when you walk into a room. I know if I go, any hotel I go to, and I have to say I go to hotels all the time, and probably almost once a week because I do travel and lecture all over. But one of the things I do is I never check in. I tell them, give me the room key, and I have to go check on the room before I solidify the deal of staying in that particular room. And very often I walk into hotel rooms, and especially when they have it like sprayed with some kind of artificial cleanser, you know, those room deodorizers, under that I can smell the mold, and I immediately get a particular symptom. What happens to me is my front lip gets completely numb, and I cannot wear any clothes that, let's say, have come from a used shop unless I wash them first. I mean, I just tend to really be able to physically feel it within seconds.
That's very true. What happens is that you've been sensitized. So at one time, perhaps in your travels when you lived in the jungle, you were exposed to quite high levels, let us say, and ever since then, that's caused an issue for you, and your body is sensitized and says it's kind of like a alarm system that your body has set up, and it just says, get out of here. There's a danger. I remember what it felt like or what I was dealing with back then. So, yes, you become sensitized. And what you smell, the smell, that moldy, musty smell, are actually volatile organic compounds, VOCs. VOCs are formed with the interaction of molds and materials, such as drywall. It starts eating through the drywall. And when it eats through the drywall, it hits the back of a paint, or if there's wallpaper, it hits the glue of the wallpaper, and it eats through that, and then it eats through the wallpaper. Well, all that is a chemical reaction and produces these volatile organic compounds. And they, in and of themselves, are toxic. So when you smell that, that's really bad, because it means you're in the middle of a toxic soup, and you better leave the place immediately. Unfortunately, people love antiques, and they buy things that come from places like that sometimes.
Yeah, you know, I was at an old car show this weekend. I'll tell you, I love that. My husband's really into old cars, and he knows every single nut and bolt. And I did notice with some of them, as beautiful as they were, if I stuck my head in the window and they had the original seats, I did immediately get that reaction. And yet people drove them there, and they didn't seem to be bothered by it.
Right. Everybody's unique and different. And everybody's immune system is different, like a fingerprint. And once you've been affected by molds, you're going to be sensitized to it. People who haven't yet been can't tell. They don't feel anything. It's only once you've had that sensitization and your immune system now recognizes the mold and the mycotoxins and the VOCs that you get what you feel. Other people feel different. Have different symptoms, but many patients tell me, yes, I can walk in a restaurant and 5 minutes later, I know there's a mold problem and I have to leave, or I'm walking to somebody's home, etc. So that's very common.
Well, in your article, which is Medical Center, well, the articles, let's see, this particular article is called Mold and Mycotoxins, Effects on the Neurological and Immune System in Humans. So it's very specifically similar to what we're talking about here, but you actually look at changes in measurable antibodies such as IgA, IgM, IgG, IgE, and that
Correct.
This can actually be measured. So people must have varying reaction levels.
Yes, yes. And I'll have a family come see me, and it'll be mom and dad and three kids. And the kids who's, let's say in one of the bedrooms was affected because of a faulty window or a leak on the roof on that side, the person in that room will have, you'd expect them to be the worse off, and sometimes they're not. And you'd expect they're all living in the same house, they're all going to have the same levels. They don't. Everyone's an individual. So that's genetic polymorphism. So everybody being different, they're all going to react differently. And some are going to have more headaches, some are going to have less. You can line up 10 people, same age, same height, same weight, and expose them to, say, a strong perfume. And you're going to have different reactions from those 10 people. Same as with these molds. Some people get very, very affected, and others not quite as badly.
Well, you also have a long list in here of different kinds of neurocognitive deficits that might develop. And, you know, we can talk about some of those. And you're actually talking about demyelination, which is quite severe. I mean, we see that in diseases such as MS.
Oh, yeah. And, by the way, that's actually a chapter in a textbook, the mixed mold, mold and mycotoxins. That's from a book. A medical textbook. What happens is that there's a number of patients that I have seen, and I'll see a family, and they'll say, you know, grandma developed, say, Alzheimer's or some other neurological condition, and it's not. It's actually, it's actually the demyelination from the molds, or younger people, say in their 30s and 40s, will have been diagnosed with MS. But it's actually not MS. It's a form of the attack on the immune system with demyelination, because MS is also a demyelination. And so a lot of these people get treated and get well and go on living a normal life. So you've got to be very astute when you diagnose some of these chronic neurological and degenerative conditions.
And look how much help you could give somebody by being the kind of physician who does check that out as a possibility. You might be able to actually seeming to reverse something that is supposed to be basically a life sentence.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, for me, this is easy, but I have the advantage of having treated patients with this for over 20 years, and, you know, the more you do something, the better you get at it. One of the problems that I see commonly in patients is that they do go see a physician who does recognize it and then treats them for a month. or 2 weeks. Well, that's way inadequate. You need to treat these patients for a number of months, and sometimes a year or two, before they really clear this out of their body. So you, even those few doctors that know a little about mold don't know how long it should be treated.
And, well, tell us, how long should it be treated?
Two things you've got to look at. Number one is, how does the patient feel? And many times the patient will tell you, you know, I feel good now. And I ask them, have you kind of plateaued, and so on and so forth, and I go through a series of questions with them. And once they've plateaued, then you don't stop it. You slowly diminish it over a period of, say, 2 to 3 weeks. You gently take it off. You don't stop it one day to the next. And that's the way it should be treated. How long? You've got to see from tests and how the patient is feeling. And sometimes you have to go from an oral antifungal, such as Sporinox, which is it's been around for 25 years, to one of the newer classes of drugs that we discussed earlier in the program. They're called echinocandins. And Cancetus is given daily, but it's given intravenously. That's the disadvantage. But you can get it daily, and once you get it daily, you don't have to go to the doctor to get it. You wear what is known as a port. You get it daily, and it shortens the length of time you need to take an antifungal. And this Cancetus and these echinocandins are very, very safe drugs. They're surprisingly safe for a drug, because even aspirin and antibiotics and common things that people take commonly have huge side effects, and you know that, what they do to a person nutritionally. However, these echinocandins are quite harmless, and they work very effectively.
But do they have to be given intravenously?
They do, unfortunately.
So you just absolutely have to have medical intervention with this.
Yes. Because these are very, very strong organisms. And with their release of mycotoxins and your suppressed immune system, you can't fight back. Or you can, but weakly. So it's like, you know, fighting someone with one hand tied behind your back. You've got to really hit it hard and get rid of it. Because, again, these spores are so tiny, they're sub-microscopic. Mold spores can't be seen under a regular microscope. They have to be seen under an electron microscope, the spores. And because they're so tiny, they get into the deepest part of your lungs when you breathe it. Plus, it can be absorbed through your skin and ingested. So you're sitting somewhere where there's mold, and you don't know it, and you're having a cup of tea. It gets into your tea, and you swallow the tea. So it gets absorbed through the skin, through the respiratory tract, and by ingesting. And they get all over. Once they're inside you, they start working their way through to the immune system, and that's how you can have all types of diseases and disorders due to these molds and mycotoxins. A very hardy individual, bugs, and very common.
So it's a whole plethora of things that need to go on. First, the combination of the healthcare practitioner and the patient have to come to realize that perhaps what they're doing isn't working, and they should look further into the now often ignored, and we still don't know exactly why it's ignored, field of mold and fungi infestation as the causative agent in the illness. And then we have a very specific protocol that can be developed, that you have developed. And is that available for all physicians, or how would they find out about this step-by-step, bring the person out of this severe mold problem?
Well, you said that you just typed in my name into PubMed, which is the National Institute of Health. It's the United States Library of Medicine, National Library of Medicine. And you type in my name, and you can see that there is a number of articles I wrote. For instance, people get a demyelinating optic neuritis. They get blurred vision. And they go see the doctor, the ophthalmologist, they try glasses, they try medication, they try drops, none of it works. Well, there's an article on exactly how to treat that. That was published 8 years ago. So none of this is new. And there's a lot of other articles if you available for doctors to read on the different types of treatments, different protocols.
But first they have to be willing to want to learn something new. It seems like, you know, doctors are so overworked and they have 8 minutes to see a patient and they just as soon write a prescription for something they're getting perhaps some kind of a payback from one of the drug companies. So it's very difficult to bring in new treatment options.
Very difficult. And you hit the nail on the head. And I'm glad you said it, because it's 8 minutes. How can you possibly find out what a patient has, do a history on them, do a physical examination, and all that in 8 minutes? It is, you can't. There's no reasonable way you can. So what you end up doing, what doctors end up doing, is they treat the symptom. Oh, you have a headache? Here's a pill. You can't sleep at night? Here's another pill. You feel tired? You must be depressed. Here, take an antidepressant. Come back, see me in a month. You know, it's very poor medicine. This is why the United States is, I think, ranked 43rd in the world as far as healthcare delivery. Other countries do much, much better than we do, and for much, much less money.
Yes, that's so true. And perhaps, you know, something's going to change, even if it's just an economic push that will come. But many people who have listened to our show today and who will be listening, because, Dr. Andrew, your show will be archived on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, and I invite you to come back and not only re-listen to it, but download it so that you have it in the future for your listeners and for your many patients that come to see you. And I do want to tell people that they'll be able to find out more shortly at www.mold-medicine.com. And what kind of advice can we close with in terms of you giving people who think that they may have a mold problem?
I would tell them, number one, you're not crazy, regardless of what some doctors may tell you. Second, get on the Internet. Start looking up things. You can find it. It's in the National Library of Medicine. I know that's highly technical, but it'll give you an idea. Print out those articles or one or two and take it to your doctor so he realizes you're not getting this from a magazine, but you're actually getting it from a published, peer-reviewed medical journal article that's in the archives of medicine at the National Library of Medicine. So with that, doctors should pay a little more attention to it. Read everything you can on the Internet, because there's a lot of information on the Internet, although you've got to be a little careful because some of it tends to be a little sensational. Find out if anybody else has it in your area. And there's a lot of groups that are formed, support groups that are formed because of this issue. So get in with them. And I have a patient of mine who wrote a book. Her name is Lori Tondini, and she wrote a book called Are You Moldy? And there's a lot of information in that book. I'm also putting out a book, but it's not ready yet. But when it is, it'll be up on the website, and people can download it, etc. So that's the advice I have for people.
Well,
don't
that's
give up
excellent.
Hope.
And thank you so much for being our guest today on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And it's just amazing that it has this long history of use. You wonder how this whole topic got dropped, since it was well known as far back as biblical times and has so much ongoing research and scientific validity to the problem, and yet it gets so overlooked. So I want to thank you so much for being our guest today on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And people can listen again online. If you heard this show and you want your friend or relative, perhaps they're having a health problem that's a mystery and they need some help figuring out what's going on with them, they certainly may want to review this show again. and perhaps look at what can they do to find out if they, in fact, have a health effect of mold or fungi. So until next time, this is Ellen Kamai, the Natural Nurse. You can always find us at naturalnurse.com on the web or Facebook, The Natural Nurse. And keep listening to Progressive Radio Network and stay healthy.